Welcome, everyone, to Bitcoin OpTech newsletter number 401 recap. Today, we're going to talk about Nested Music 2 in Lightning, or potentially using Nested Music 2 in Lightning. We're also going to talk about formal verification, this time in SecP in the modular scalar multiplication. And we have five entries in our changes to services and client software. And then we have our weekly segments on releases, release candidates, and notable code and documentation changes. This week, Merch, Gustavo, and I are joined by a couple guests, and we'll have them introduce themselves. Remix, you want to say hi and talk about what you're working on?
Hi, I'm Remix, and I'm working with form methods on cryptography.
Awesome. Luis?
Hey, I'm Luis. I'm a grantee from Bitcoin Dev Kit. I'm currently working on wallet integrations with eChexo.
Excellent. We're going to go a little bit out of order since we have our guests on. We will jump to the second news item titled Formal Verification of SecP 256K1 Modular Scalar Multiplication. Remix, you posted to the Bitcoin Dev mailing list about a project that you have apparently been working on for some time to formally verify parts of SecP's implementation. Maybe to start off, how would you articulate for listeners what it means for something to be formally verified?
Yes, so what it means to formally verify is basically you write a mathematical specification of what a program should do, and then you write a proof that the code that you're verifying matches the proof, so that it actually computes what the proof says. And then you use a proof assistant to mechanically check that every step of the proof. So you don't have a teacher or professor checking your proof, but the computer is actually doing that part.
Okay. I think it makes sense. Maybe you can walk us through the example, and maybe not an example, but the project that you've worked on here in terms of SecP. And maybe that'll help. Maybe you can mention some of the tooling and how it works so we can connect that explanation to something more tangible.
Yeah, so what I've been working on since the beginning of the year is proof of concept, and it's part of my OpenSats grant. I'm evaluating different tool chains to do this form verification. So form verification is not a new concept. It has been done by different people over the years. And so basically, I'm looking at the code base of SecP and evaluating which tools I can use for doing that. And the first tool chain I use was the verified software tool chain. It's arguably the most well-studied or most used oldest tool chain for doing this kind of work on C. And it was originally developed at Princeton, and I now think it's continued to work on at the University of Chicago. And basically what you can do with it is you have a program that converts your C code into an abstract syntax tree that you can then reason about inside a proof assistant. And because all that is quite a bit of work, I started with a single function of a signature generation and verification, and that is this modular scalar multiplication. And all that function really does is it multiplies A with B and then does modulo N. So it's a small function, has about 300 lines of code. And the proof to check this function is alone 6,000 lines of proof code. But what you get from that is a guarantee that for any input, not just specific unit tests of tests you're doing with fuzzing, for any possible input, which is 2 to the power of 512, it will always work. It will always give you the correct result, and it will not have like a memory leak or an integer overrun, overflow, or any other kind of undefined behavior. Does that explain it a little?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I'm curious. You mentioned some of the types of errors or behavior that would be avoided by formally verifying. What is that list? Maybe the top items, or if there's a smaller list, the list an entire thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, in general, it is the memory safety than any kind of integer overflows or division by zero. Yeah, that's basically the main things. And the motivation for this is also because when you look at crypto code, the cryptographers are very well at designing new algorithms and primitives. So they go through rounds of review. They may be going through standardization, but the actual bugs in crypto code are implementation errors. And this is what we are preventing with this.
I see. On the Brink engineering call, we had on Russell O'Connor, who did some formal verification of safe GCD in LibSecP. And he walked through some of his tools and approaches to that. I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work and if you built on that work, or is this sort of like a different stack that you're using or a different approach?
No, I am not 100% sure, but I think he also used the VST. He also acquired a license to use some parts that are not free. So I'm pretty sure it's the same stack.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. Maybe listeners would be curious about like the level of effort that went into this, because I think folks hear these benefits and just, I think, initially would say, yeah, let do it all. Like, have all the code bases, you know, formally verified. So maybe you can articulate what you can and cannot formally verify, and also like some indication of like how much work went into this.
Yeah, that is a usual answer to that. Like, yeah, let's just verify everything. And that's where you have to stop him. In theory, you can formally verify like any code, any C code, but it takes some tremendous work. So for the verified software toolchain, a general rule that I've seen in other works and papers is that for a single line of C code, you have 20 lines of proof code. And what does proof code mean? It's basically steps that you take, as they call tactics, that you are used to convince the proof assistant, that you're like basically the cheater, the checker, that what you're actually doing is correct. And yeah. And in terms of time, this is the first time I used the VST. I've used other proof assistants for other projects before. But it took me about, I would say, 2 to 3 months to get used to ROC and the VST, and then 5 weeks to do this scalar multiplication. Yeah.
So now that you know how to, how to do it, obviously you would be way faster for doing it for another one, right?
Of course, yeah. And there is like more advanced, so to say, tactics, like steps convincing the proof assistant that I haven't really touched or understood. So there is room for not just like being better at it myself, but also using more advanced tools as well. But this 20-to-1 rule is kind of general.
Right. So how does that proof code factor into it? Is the proof code that reflective of the work the software stack then has to plow through, or do you write it manually, the proof code, or
how does it work together? The proof code you write manually, and maybe we can talk about writing it with an AI later. But yeah, you write the proof code, and it's an interactive process. So you have your current goal and state that accepted by the proof assistant, and then you basically give him a tactic to form that rule or the goal or the current state, and then you try to bring them together. So the state should at the end be the same as the goal. And sometimes you run in the wrong direction doing your proof, as maybe listeners are familiar with, like doing the informal proofs with pen and paper in like undergraduate studies or something. you sometimes you go in the wrong direction, you have to start over. And it's very similar to doing pen and paper proofs.
Okay, cool. So what's your overall project? You now did a formal proof for a single function, from what I understand, right? And
yeah.
Is the idea to have a full formal verification of the libsecp library, or is this generally secp and can be used by any implementer of it? How does it work?
Yeah, so the overall goal, I think I also wrote it in the blog post, is that, of course, you'd want to have a fully verified secp library. But right now, I'm still in the exploration phase, like looking at different proof assistants. This was the first one. And of course, there's other tools that might have better automation or other workflows. And once I know which tool to use, then of course the goal is to have a end-to-end verified libsecp code.
I know in some cases, testing requires some refactoring to get things sort of appropriately modularized for the testing. Is that the same case here with formal verification? And if so, I've heard that SecP is pretty modular, and so you can just jump in and start, you know, picking off functions, or does there need to be work at the SecP layer to architect it for this sort of work?
Yes. So there's two things that the various verified software toolchain does not support. And it's first returning a struct from a function that is used in libsecp. And the second one is assignment of struct. So you have to assign every field of a struct manually. That is a refactor you definitely have to do. And on the other side, which I also did for this project, is the original code used macros very heavily for the computation of, some results. And I had to convert these to inline functions. So instead of macros, you have an C inline function, because otherwise you can't really use a divide and conquer strategy. So you try to prove a single helper function. Let's say it just adds two numbers, and then you have another one that multiplies two numbers, and then you kind of get to have a modular proof. And if you would have to have like macros, then you would have the entire big function and have to do the proof all at once. And it has to be seen if turning macros into inline function has like any performance implications. But I think with the modern compilers, it shouldn't really be a problem.
Have you been following along, Remix, with some of the discussion on the mailing list this past week about Hornet node and the attempts there to do formal verification on Bitcoin consensus rules?
I've read the mails, but I haven't really looked into the Hornet node yet. So I understand that they implement a domain-specific language for C++. But I don't think they're doing actual formal verification of the consensus code. I think the project is more about formalizing the actual rules at this point. But I don't know.
Yeah, that was my understanding too. Toby Sharp was on a while back and was talking about trying to, as a byproduct or as one of the two products he's trying to develop while creating Hornet node, he wants to try to formally specify the Bitcoin protocol. So I think that's related, but not quite exactly the same. He has also been implementing a lot of the cryptography around it, from what I understand. He was implementing ECDSA signing and things like that. So maybe he would be an interesting conversation partner in this regard.
Yeah. As for the consensus code, it's all written in C++, and formally verification of C++ is a very difficult thing. I think many people tried and failed. And so I don't know if that is possible with current tooling.
If there's listeners that are curious about this sort of work and the details, obviously there's the post that you have up on remix7531.com that they can go to. What other resources would you put point people to who might be curious about tinkering with this sort of thing? Are there like onboarding to formal verification resources out there, or just check out your posts?
Yes, there's a very great book series. It's named Software Foundations. It has multiple volumes, and you can use it to learn how to use Rock, the proof assistant I'm using, and it's interactive. So you shouldn't really read it as a PDF or in the browser. You should be opening it in your editor, and then you can read along and do the examples or the exercises. And it's a really great way to learn about form verification. And if you're interested in my work, you can go on my website. And I'm a very big fan of just writing somebody an email. And then that's how you can get in touch with me.
Okay, excellent. Well, that's probably a good spot to wrap up, Merch, unless you had any follow-up questions. Okay. Well, Remix, thank you for your time. Thank you for your work on this and for joining us to explain it today. We will move down now to the last two items in the Changes to Services and Client Software monthly segment. First one is U3XOD 0.5 being released. Luis, I know you touch a bit of both this as well as Floresta, and I was hoping if we had you on for one, you could help us with the other. U3XOD 0.5, do you want to talk a little bit about why that is an important release and what's in there?
Yeah. So like UTXO is basically, we are trying to compress the UTXO set in a way that fits into like lightweight devices like phones or a router, whatever. Like currently with Bitcoin Core, anything that uses UTXO set, we can't really do that because the UTXO set is huge. And we need to do a lot of lookups on the LevelDB to validate stuff. So that pretty much puts phones and anything lightweight out of the question. So Tej came up with UTXO back in 2019. It introduces two new types of nodes. The first one is a bridge, which pretty much for each new block, it creates a Merkle proof for the block and creates a forest of Merkle trees to model the whole UTXO set. So like each UTXO is a leaf on that tree. And then we also have CSNs, which are compact state nodes, which rely on proofs generated by the bridge. So let's say you mine a new block, the bridge will receive that, is gonna add the UTXOs for the block on the tree and remove the UTXOs that were spent. And then when a CSN receives a block, he doesn't have a UTXO set, so he can't really validate the block without extra information. So he asks for UTXO proofs for the bridge, which are just Merkle inclusion proofs, so that he can verify that those UTXOs that are being spent are actually in the UTXO set. So with these new batch of releases, we are mainnet compatible. There's 3 BIPs for UTXO, which are BIPs 181, 182, and 183. We are like using the P2P implementation that's defined there. We also introduced Swift Sync. So we have a huge problem that when we are doing IBD, when a CSN is doing IBD, he needs to ask for a proof for each block, right? Those proofs represent like almost 70% overhead. So it's a lot of data for you to download. So with SwissSync, you can like cut that a lot because we only need proofs from the height SwissSync ends. And so we cut back on a lot of data. For Floresta, we recently swapped the old Lipkin consensus for kernel, which is a lot better maintained and more performant. And we are doing a lot of work to get that like production ready.
Maybe you can comment a little bit. You mentioned bridge nodes. You mentioned the compact state nodes. We have U3XOD. We have Floresta. Which of those projects implements which of those types of nodes? And maybe you can just kind of connect the architecture that you outlined with these bridge and compact state nodes to these two pieces of software. Do they both implement both? Or maybe explain that a little bit.
Yeah. So U3XOD is a fork of BTCD with U3XO support implemented. And Floresta is made from scratch. So it's a composable set of libraries that you can use to build nodes. We have like the main production node, which is Floresta D, which is built on top of those set of crates. But like other people can use those crates to build nodes that fit their own application. So you can like embed a node inside a wallet. You can put in a device, whatever you want. I managed to compile Floresta to run my router. So I have a node in my router. That's just like just one of the possibilities is this.
And if I'm running a bridge node, am I running U3XOD, Floresta D, or I can run either? I can compose my own with the modular Floresta libraries, or how does that work?
No, so the only implementation of a bridge you have today is U3XOD. Floresta is an implementation of the CSN. But like, there's nothing impeding you to making a bridge with Floresta. It's just not a focus right now.
Okay, just to recap. So the main idea with U3XO is that we usually don't want to trust other nodes for the validity of data. We just take the data from them and then verify everything ourselves on our nodes. And with U3XO, we prove that the data is correct, and therefore we can just provide the proofs in order for or receive the proofs, validate the proofs, and then update our U3XO set, U3XO set representation, which is just a minuscule tree of Merkle trees, I think a forest of Merkle trees to prove that a U3XO exists, and then with the updates, whether it got spent. And so we're talking about two pieces of software here that we have both updates for in the newsletter. One is U3XO D, which I think is the more comprehensive implementation so far that implements a so-called bridge node. The bridge node sort of does the legacy validation, but then provides proofs. And Floresta is currently only a compact state node or CSN that can process proofs and then update the representation, the forest of Merkle trees of the U3XO set on its end. And that one is running in your router, right?
Yeah, that's yeah, so like not exactly. So the bridge keeps a forest of Merkle trees representing each U3XO. And Floresta only keeps the roots of those trees. So let's say Floresta receives a block, it validates all the scripts, all the transactions, like any other nodes, like use the same consensus engine as Bitcoin Core. So, but like he cannot verify that those U3XOs are indeed present in the U3XO set. So he asks for a proof to the bridge. Like, prove to me that these U3XOs are in the U3XO set. So like with that inclusion proof, I can verify that the root hash is the same that I have.
Right. That's basically a Merkle branch to one specific root in the forest. And because you have the roots of the Merkle trees, you can now look at the right root, attach the Merkle branch, and if that proof that was provided, all the hashing steps compute, then obviously the U3XO must be present in the tree.
Exactly. Yeah, and the other point that it touched about like wallets fetching data, like this is one of the biggest points of this, because pretty much any wallet today just hits an API like Explorer, Electrum, or whatever. Like with Explorer, we don't have any guarantees about the data. Electron can provide some inclusion proofs as well, but you're still not verifying anything. And what's huge about this is you can embed this into any application. So let's say you have a mobile wallet, you can have a node running there. It's going to receive every block. It's going to validate every block and let you absolutely sure of the validity of the information.
Right. Usually thin clients can be lied to by omission. So the server or other node that they're getting data from can just tell them, no, there's nothing interesting for you here. While there is maybe a UTXO or transaction that is relevant to the thin client, this is not possible in the UTXO model, because you can actually prove the existence of every UTXO, and you can actually also prove that something was spent by showing, I think the, if I remember, I read the BIP so long while back, like half a year ago. If I remember correctly, all of the trees are sorted, and therefore, if you show the leaf that would be to the left of the one that you're looking for, and the leaf to the right of the one you're looking for, and obviously the leaf for that UTXO is not present, you can even prove that a UTXO no longer exists with this model.
Yeah. Yeah, like without mentioning like the privacy concerns, because when you're using Splatter or Electron, you're hitting an endpoint, you're telling, this is my address and this is my IP. Like, with UTXO and Floresta, you remove that out of the equation completely. Because you just act like a normal Bitcoin node on a network. There's no honeypot indexing servers or anything like that.
Right, and then every transaction you process has to be translated by a bridge node, which then adds the Merkle proofs for the UTXOs to the forest of Merkle trees that we have the roots of, and therefore you basically trade off compute and bandwidth for less data storage and more privacy. Yeah,
and it's super light. Like, it takes like 200 megabytes of RAM. We don't keep any blocks, so we validate a block and throw it away. So pretty much no storage as well. It also implements compact block filters, so we can do full scans backwards. So it's pretty complete piece of software. I don't know.
Yeah, that sounds pretty awesome. Now, just to be clear, you said earlier the bandwidth overhead for blocks is roughly 70%. So while you're catching up your node, for a full archive node, you basically download 1.7 times as much data as the whole blockchain. How much do you download with the CSN? You must process the proofs in some way, I assume.
Yeah.
Do you download all of that too?
So you can choose to either download every block since Genesis and validate them. Then you're going to have a huge bandwidth usage. But we can also do something called assume UTXO, which is kind of like assume UTXO, where you choose a, like, you can export a height in a set of roots. You can stay at some height and you can skip IBD. So that's the default on the binary. Every release, we make a new checkpoint and it's going to automatically jump to that height. You can also sync from Genesis. It's going to take like just as much as Bitcoin Core takes. And you can also do something called backfill. So you skip IBD and then you validate blocks backwards in the background. So the node is up and running very fast.
Cool. Very nice. How closely do you work with the BIP authors? I've been hoping to get an update on the BIPs. They've been open for quite a while. They read very well in the last iteration already. But it seems like the software is coming out before the BIPs here.
Yeah, like I work with them very closely. There's still a lot of architectural decisions to be made, so we don't want to drop anything too fast, you know, make it right.
I think we covered both of those pieces of software pretty good. Luis, any calls to action for listeners in terms of testing, using, contributing, feedback, anything like that?
At the moment, I'd say run a bridge.
How many people are running bridges these days, and how do you quantify that being like a bottleneck?
I mean, right now, not a lot of people. I think not a lot of people know about this. It's not really that much of a bottleneck right now because we don't have a lot of users, but it will be interesting to have more people running bridges so we can decentralize this kind of node running.
That brings me to a follow-up question. I don't know if you already stated that, but can the compact state nodes forward the proofs for blocks, or do the proofs always have to come from bridge nodes? So would it be enough to have like a handful of bridge nodes and then the proofs propagate around the compact state nodes? Or do you actually need to have sort of a one-to-one relationship from every compact state node to bridge nodes?
That's in the plan, but not currently. We still need to implement proof caching on the CSNs. But yeah, in the future, we only need like a few bridges for it to work. Because the idea is, I don't know, like a CSN wants to broadcast a transaction, it's going to cache the proof for his UTXOs, and then he attaches that to the transaction when he wants to broadcast. So nobody needs to ask a bridge for those proofs. But that's not implemented yet.
Maybe my antagonistic mind here is going a little too far, but how concerned would you be about the network splitting at the points of the bridges? If there's only a handful of bridges and, I don't know, maybe a weird transaction causes them to fail, wouldn't that split off the entire UTXO subset of nodes? Have you guys been discussing that?
No, that doesn't work because CSNs can also talk to normal Bitcoin core nodes. Like most of the blocks will be fetched from normal Bitcoin core peers. He only needs the bridges for the proofs.
But a CSN without the proofs cannot update the tree, right? The forest of Merkle trees, right? Because they don't actually have the UTXOs. So they can't construct the update. So what does it help them to get the legacy format blocks? Maybe I'm missing something here.
Yeah, like in a sense, they would be stuck, but there would not be a chain split. Like they can.
Oh, okay. Blocks. So you're saying they would be aware that a new block has come and they are aware that they haven't received the content of the block yet. And therefore it would be hard to trick them, or they would sort of be able to at least realize that they should pause and wait because okay, I see.
They're just going to block when asking proofs. They're not going to split to another chain or anything like that.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Luis, thanks for joining us. We appreciate your time. We appreciate your work on this novel, Light Clients, and you're free to drop. We understand if you have other things to do.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Cheers. We're going to jump back up to the news section. We have our first item, discussion of using nested MuSig 2 in the Lightning Network. This was a post by Z-Man. And if you are a listener of the show or reader of the newsletter, you know that his proposals can get somewhat technical. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to join us today. So Merch and I are going to try to give an overview of it. And maybe we can touch base with him at some point in the future on this when we have him on for other discussions. But he posted to Delving Bitcoin, quote, towards a K of N Lightning Network node, unquote. And in it, he sort of proposes this question, can we make a multi-sig self-custodial wallet with Lightning Network integration? He puts forth the use case of someone who owns Bitcoin and maybe wants to use it to generate routing fees on the Lightning Network. But somebody who owns Bitcoin doesn't really want to give away their Bitcoin for someone to operate that. And so he comes up with this idea, hey, can we make signing on the Lightning Network K of N so that the owner can have some keys? Maybe there's some other operator that's doing the routing or some such thing. And or even if they're just doing it themselves, they can not have it all in one key. And so he's building on this idea of nested MuSig 2, which I think was a paper from a couple months ago. He touches on Frost as well to be able to achieve this. But he brings up in this post that there is part of the Bolt specification that might need to change in order to enable this. And this is part of the Lightning spec that has to do with the SHA chain, which is how revocation keys are handled. And maybe Merch, you can bail me out with this, but that needs to be modified to be optional. So I think there's an optimization there, so you don't need to hold all the past revocation keys. And that optimization is sort of incompatible with this K of N signature scheme that he's proposing. So he's proposing to make that piece of the spec optional so that maybe there could be these sorts of channels in the future. There's more work to be done, but that's what I took away from the post.
Okay, maybe a couple comments first. The idea here is to make one of the two sides in the channel K of N, right? The channel in principle is already two of two, but then one of the two out of the two of two would be a K of N under the hood. And from reading this post, or rather the news item here, my understanding is that the way that the state progression in the channel is managed usually, you get a new step in a chain of secrets that depends on the previous. And for some reason, this is difficult to do when you don't have a single key, but multiple involved keys, because it's derived from key material. So if the key material is distributed, I think you can't have this SHA chain, and that's where that is coming from, is my understanding here. So the problem basically seems to be, if you have a two or three on-chain wallet on the other end, you can't easily just plug that two or three the construction into the Lightning channel on that side, because other things in how the Lightning channel is managed depend on there being a single key and being able to derive information from the private key material.
Yeah, so a bunch of different pieces of technology. So there's part of the Lightning spec here. We're talking about MuSig 2. He mentions in order to get the K of N features, we're talking about Frost. So there's a lot of big picture moving pieces here. For folks who are curious about the details, obviously jump into the Delving Bitcoin post, because I'm sure we did not fully do this idea justice. And so you all can explore maybe on your own some of the details. Merch, anything else you'd like to say about this item?
I wanted to add a little more. So generally, I think Zeman has been writing about several of these ideas before. So he has written about channel factories before. He had another proposal that proposed a sort of Lightning channel battery that was shared between multiple large entities and was essentially a single, much more slowly updating shared channel between many parties. So the idea was that these large holders might have channels crisscrossing between each other, but then they would have one big UTXO that they have shared control of that uses a different scheme than Lightning that they could reassign the payout from in order to rebalance their network of channels among each other on a maybe once per day basis. So this is at least contextually fits with the other proposals that Zeman has been thinking about. I think that all of these would still benefit from ideas like template hash or any prevout as a predecessor to achieve Allen symmetry, and or other covenant proposals that would make them much less interactive or more powerful. I think Zeman's background idea in this context is that he thinks it's unlikely for such a covenant proposal to be adopted, and therefore comes up with constructions that can work under the current existing consensus rules, but they tend to be a little more complicated, involved, and highly interactive in order to work around the non-existence of these covenant proposals.
Back down to our monthly segment, we have Cold Card 6.5.0. And this release has a few different things that we noted. One is the ability to assign music to UTXOs. There is also a feature around signed message, BIP 322, for proof of reserves for Miniscript and music to UTXOs. There's also new support for Miniscript and MiniTapScript. Taproot spending, signing, multisig, TapScript up to 8 leaves. The BIP 129, which is the Bitcoin secure multisig setup, is also added in terms of support. And so it feels like a larger than normal cold card release and some good Bitcoin tech in there. Frigate 1.4.0 released. We covered Frigate in a previous newsletter that was 389. And we've had Craig Raw on as well. But Frigate is essentially an Electrum server, which is basically a backend for silent payment scanning. And we talked with him a little bit about GPUs and some of the performance that I think he squeezed out of that. I don't remember if we talked with him or if we talked about it, but we covered that in the show previously. But with 1.4, sounds like Frigate is now using this ultra-fast SECP256K1 library in addition to the GPU computation. And I think it's like 14 times faster using that library. So I'm unsure the details of those optimizations. I've seen this library talked about on Delving, but I didn't dive into it until this is the first time I've seen someone using it. So that's interesting. Merch, did you get a chance to look at this?
A little bit. So I saw some discussion about this library, and I sort of wanted comment on the trade-offs here. Basically, this is a re-implementation of libsecp with a ton of LLM assisted improvements and speedups and so forth. So I would say that from a level of review, it would obviously be much less trusted than libsecp, which is extremely well vetted and has a lot of people looking at it. This is a almost completely new library that has some, I don't know, tens of thousands of lines of code that were output by a single developer with assistance of, according to himself, I think, with the assistance of LLMs. So the goal of this one is to be very, very fast. And so the trade-off, I think, that is attractive here is when you're only doing validation work and not, for example, signing transactions and sending funds, this library could be very interesting in order to do the validation more quickly, which is what Frigate is using it here for. And in that case, maybe you're a little less worried about bugs or correctness or unvetted code, because you're only validating and you're reading data, not creating data. So maybe in this context, this is a good fit. I've also seen that Toby Sharp, the Hornet Node developer, was interested in seeing how quickly Hornet Node would perform if it used ultra fast SECP instead of libsecp. So this is on the one hand a very interesting and useful effort to have such a fast library, but on the other hand, it's probably not something that will get adopted quickly on the wallet side of libsecp usage, where people might be much more interested in it taking its time, but being secure, not having side channels, having constant time implementations, and so forth.
Yeah, I know some of the delving posts around this library were seeking feedback. And I think one of the pieces of feedback was, hey, this is like tens of thousands of lines of like cryptographic type code. And it's going to be hard to get feedback on a huge chunk of that. But like you mentioned, maybe there's a use case for something that's faster and isn't necessarily the wallet itself. And so maybe this thing will evolve over time and get more eyeballs on it due to its usage.
I think one of the interesting things might be if you have a highly trusted piece of software, or highly vetted, I should say, piece of software like libsecp, I should be very precise here to be clear, you might be able to do some cross-implementation fuzzing that verifies that the results of another implementation matches exactly. So I don't know, maybe the implementer could look into some fuzz comparison, throwing the same fuzz inputs against libsecp and ultrafast secp and seeing that it matches in results all across.
Yeah, I wonder if Bitcoin fuzz, which I think is differential fuzzing, could do something like that. I'm not sure if they're fuzzing libsecp currently, but interesting idea to piggyback on the correctness of one and use the speed of the other. Cool. And our last piece of software in the monthly segment was Bitcoin Backbone updates. There were two posts to the Bitcoin Dev mailing list about updates to Bitcoin Backbone. This is a piece of software we covered a few months ago that is building a node on top of Bitcoin kernel. And the developer posted to the mailing list about two updates. One was around compact block support, another one around multi-process improvements, and a little bit of under the hood work. But I thought it was interesting. Obviously, there's kernel involved here. We're talking about compact block support. I think it's an interesting proof of concept, interesting prototype that people might want to poke at. We can jump to the releases and release candidates, and we can bring in Gustavo, who's authored this as well as the Notable Code segment.
Concora version 31 has been released on Sunday, I think, the 19th. So we'll probably be reporting more deeply on the content of the 31 release next week. And then Gustavo seems to be back and we'll do Core Lightning.
Yeah, thank you, Merge. Sorry for the technical issues. So this week we have two releases, which are two release candidates from Bitcoin Core 31 and Core Lightning 2604. Both of these have now been released fully. So in the next newsletter, we'll cover their full release. I just want to point out, if someone's interested in more details around the Bitcoin Core 31 and specifically the testing guide for the release candidate, we did dig in into that in newsletter 397 in the podcast related to newsletter 397. And Core Lightning 2604 is now was at its third release candidate when we wrote this past newsletter, but we first covered it in the newsletter and the episode 398. So we do go into more detail into that, but in those episodes. But we'll have more news for the next newsletter and the next episode when we cover the full versions, not just release candidates. I just want to say that the Core Lightning release was very much focused on splicing. So now that splicing has been merged in the Bolt Ripple story, Core Lightning has made many upgrades around its implementation, one which we'll cover in the notable code and documentation changes section. Awesome. So we move forward with that section. This week we have two items for Bitcoin Core. The first one, 34.401, is the extension in the libbitcoin kernel API that we've covered multiple times, specifically in newsletter 280 and 390. So the support for block header for obtaining block headers through that API interface, which was added in newsletter 290, is now extended by adding a method that serializes a block header into its standard byte encoding. So initially, after newsletter 290, you could have used this block header support, but you weren't able to obtain it in a serialized format into its standard byte encoding. So you would need external serialization code if your external program wanted to store, transmit, or compare a serialized header. Now this is no longer required, and you can just use this method to leverage that. And why would someone want to do that? The practical example is that once you serialize the header through the API, you could feed those bytes to basically hash the header into obtaining the block hash to compute the block hash, right? So you don't need now an external program that leverages the libbitcoin kernel API doesn't need a separate serialization code, can just simply use this API through its new method to get the standard byte encoding of a block header and use it for computing a block hash, for example. The next item, 35.032. Here, there's work being done on a feature that was introduced in newsletter 288 called the private broadcast option, which allows users to broadcast transactions through short-lived Tor or I2P connections or through the Tor proxy to IPv4 or IPv6 peers. The goal here is for Bitcoin Core to open a short-term connection, broadcast a transaction, and then close that short-term connection. However, the issue was that when using the private broadcast through those short-lived connections, some peer addresses learned could then be added to Bitcoin Core's peer address manager. So what this new item does is that it basically ensures that it will never store a network address learned when using the private broadcast option. It will never store it in the address manager, so that this feature can basically be, not only it hardens the privacy of this feature, but it now lives all the information learned through these privacy or these short-lived connections are now isolated from the rest of your normal usage.
Yes. That was one of the things that I was curious about. So if we only do a version handshake, send our single transaction, ping and pong, and then disconnect, I think what we're not doing is asking for addresses from that peer. And I was sort of wondering, I think from my understanding, that we shouldn't be usually getting any addresses from that peer in that period of time. It would sort of be an unexpected behavior of the counterparty, the peer that we're connecting to, that they send us any addresses. Or it might be referring to if this node were in our unknown table and we connect and we find a peer there, we would add it to the tried table so that it would be an update of the specific peer that we actually connected to that gets updated. But I even just went over the pull request. I couldn't really see where we should ever expect to learn addresses. So if you know and what I'm missing there, please fill us in. Otherwise, maybe our listeners can tell us on Twitter or somewhere.
Yeah, to be fully honest, I reached that blocker too, right? So it wasn't clear to me either. At first, I thought it was the new short-lived identity that you gain would be added in the address manager, but then the PR description basically makes you think that it's about peer addresses that are learned through that connection. So yeah, I would then say that if someone's listening and knows the answer, that'd be great. Because yeah, it's not super clear exactly. It probably is just a fail-safe to make sure that it would never happen, even if it's just not normal behavior, at least from the description and the discussion in the pull request. It seems to just be a preventive measure that doesn't necessarily happen in a regular flow. But yeah, if someone knows the answer, we'd love to learn more about that. Moving forward with core lining, two new items are from core lining this week. The first one is the enabling of splicing by default by removing it from the experimental status. So when I was covering earlier the release section, I mentioned a few changes around splicing. So splicing is now considered fully default and production ready on core lining. And if you want to learn more about the merging of the splicing protocol into the Bolt specification, or the work that core lining splicing implementation did at the same time that the splicing protocol was merged in the Bolt specification, and newsletter 398 and the accompanying podcast episode, we invited Dusty from the core lining team to basically tell us about both the work done in the splicing protocol in the lining specification and on core lining that was fully attached to it, right? So that episode has more details around that, but for now we can say that core lining, probably in preparation for this 26.04 release, has now considered splicing a default feature and production ready feature. Next, core lining 9046. Here there was some interoperability issue between the keysend implementation between core lining and LDK, where LDK was expecting a final CLTV expiry value, or the CLTV expiry delta for the last hop, to be 42 when receiving a keysend payment. Core lining, however, was sending a 22 value when sending a keysend payment. What would happen is that LDK would simply refuse to receive a keysend payment sent from an LDK receiver because core lining used a different value than LDK. And this value is the safety margin the recipient wants on the last hop. So if something were to fail, it would still have enough time to claim the HTLC on-chain if the upstream counterparty became unresponsive and an on-chain resolution was needed. So LDK was basically just telling core lining, this is not enough time for me as a receiver to handle this edge case. So now core lining raises this value so it matches LDK's, and now keysend payments are now back again fully interoperable between these two implementations. The next two are from the LDK repository. So a pattern in this newsletter is that there are multiple features that have switched from experimental status to production feature status. That was the case for splicing on core lining, and is now also the case for zero fee commitment channels on LDK. So the feature bit is promoted from the experimental to the production feature bit. We covered in newsletter 371 LDK's initial implementation of zero fee commitment channels, which replaced the two anchor outputs from regular anchor channels with one shared pay to anchor output that has a zero fee value, because we don't want to predict, we cannot predict the on-chain fees required in advance. So this makes it more flexible and modular for future fee conditions. So LDK is the first implementation to not only implement the zero fee commitment channels feature, but also to promote it to a production feature bit. However, when other implementations would be ready to move to that production feature bit, they could be interoperable with LDK. The next one on LDK, 4558. Here, something called a receiver-side timeout that is present in multipath payments is now extended to also cover key send payments. So basically, when you send a multipath payment, if one of the multiple parts fails to reach the destination, the receiver can have a timeout where he will fail back all the different HTLC parts back to the sender after it has reached a timeout, so that he can avoid having HTLC slots tied up and consumed. However, this wasn't properly implemented in key send payments. So an LDK node that would receive a key send payment and one of the a key send payment that use the multipath payments method, if one of the multiple parts was stuck, then the sender would have to wait until the final CLTB expiry for those HTLC slots to be freed up again. So now the receiver side timeout, which was already present in other forms of transactions that use multipath payments, but not key send payments, is now extended to cover key send. So now a receiver can always fail back those HTLCs and those simple parts or the whole key send payment and free up HTLC slots instead of having to wait for a longer period until the CLTV expires, the CLTV expiry timeout, regular timeout for all sorts of payments. So the next three are, or the next one, LND 9985, is also, like I said, part of the similar pattern where things are getting promoted to production feature bits. So in this case, it's simple taproot channels, which are promoted to the production feature bits with a distinct commitment type called simple taproot final. So there's an optimization around the tap scripts that are used for these types of channels, which will now use op checksig verify instead of a mix of op checksig and op drop. There's also another improvement that were something called map-based nonce handling that are key to the funding transaction IDs. So basically, as we've discussed in previous episodes and newsletters, when the simple taproot channels that are funded through a MuSig 2 wallet, they have to change nonces every time they sign a different funding transaction. There's more interchange in the nonces being used on MuSig 2 channels. So every nonce has to be properly mapped to a different funding transaction ID as groundwork for future splicing. So this promotion to production doesn't just come with a new feature bit. It also comes with an optimization on the tap script that is being used, but also just properly better mapping between the nonce handling and the funding transaction ID as groundwork for future splicing. So we can probably expect splicing on simple taproot channels to be a follow-up work in LND from this. But yeah, this basically is the third promotion to production feature in this newsletter: splicing, core lining, zero fee commitment channels in LDK, and now simple taproot channels in LND. The next one is an addition in BTC Pay Server, pull request number 7250, where loot 21, loot being the LN URL spec. So support for loot 21 is added, which basically means an unauthenticated endpoint, or an endpoint that doesn't require authentication, named Verify, that allows an external service to verify whether a Bolt 11 invoice created via LNURL pay has been settled. So as a sender, I have the pre-image after I've sent a payment and I can verify that I sent a payment. However, if I'm, let's say, a website that is feeding Bolt 11 invoice on behalf of a receiver, I might not have full confirmation that the payment was settled. I'm not the sender, so I don't get the pre-image. So this endpoint allows an external service that to get a confirmation from the BTC Pay server, a Lightning node behind a BTC Pay server instance, that an Bolt 11 invoice created via LNURL pay has properly been settled, even if I'm not the sender or the receiver, I'm just an external service working or providing invoices on behalf of the receiver. The next
This one's interesting because some of the very early websites that used Lightning payments, I think there was a demo of a like forum like construction or blogging website called htlc.me very early on, 2017, 2018. And what they did was basically just when the person that was trying to read the article had paid the invoice, they would show the proof of payment, the pre-image that they received back from settling the payment, and then forward that to the browser and would be able to see the content. Of course, that meant that now also the website could basically prove that it had paid the invoice because it also had the pre-image. And with this way, you sort of get a different way. You now trust the server to say, yeah, this has been paid, and you can serve the content without having to forward the pre-image and giving the proof out of hand that you paid the invoice. Although, of course, most of the time it just matters whether something was paid or not, not that you can prove that you were it that paid it. So interesting addition here.
Yeah, certainly. This I haven't seen it being implemented in other like instances. I think BTC Pay server must be one of the first to implement such features. So yeah, definitely interesting. So the next and the final item is the pull request 29.89 in the BIPS repository, which publishes BIP 376, which defines new input per input fields on PSVT version 2 to carry BIP 352 tweak data needed to sign and spend silent payment outputs. So this complements BIP 375, which we had covered previously, I believe in newsletter 237, that basically allowed or specified how to create silent payments outputs using PSBTs. So 376 is a natural follow-up and the completion to be able not only to create silent payment outputs using PSBTs, but also to be able to sign for them and spend them using PSBTs as well. Merch?
Yeah, so PSBTs or partially signed Bitcoin transactions are always employed when you either have multiple devices involved in creating a transaction or even multiple senders in participating in creation of a transaction. So we already had a specification for how to facilitate a multi-user transaction that pays to silent payments, which is BIP 375. And now we also have a specification how to implement spending silent payment inputs, right? So obviously you need a bunch of data about the previous transaction in order to be able to construct a silent payments input. And then to have the silent payments input exist next to to other inputs requires some additional information. This has been coming for a while, finally out there. If you're a wallet developer that is working on PayJoin and wants to support silent payments, I think now that sort of stuff is ready. So maybe take a look.
this, and there's been so many different BIPs related to silent payments, right? The first one, BIP 352, which defines silent payments. But then like 375, that basically defines how to send silent payments or create outputs, is preceded by BIP 274, which defines how to create the discrete log equivalency proofs that are required for that. But then there's also BIP 392, which describes the descriptor format. And now we have 376, which defines how to sign and spend those outputs. Would that be the complete full picture, or is anything else needed to implement silent payments?
I think it's pretty much the complete picture, especially if we have now additional software like Frigate that can allow light clients to more easily catch up with the silent payments information. There are also, I think, 4 or 5 silent payments implementations already in production use. So I assume that they are not PSBT compatible yet, and I haven't really got full information right here what exactly they all support and whether they can, for example, do multi-user transactions or anything like that in general, just not for silent payments. But I think that should be all of the necessary parts to sort of get silent payments in multi-user transactions, silent payment support for thin clients, and basically just I'm still excited to see it also come out in Bitcoin Core. Hopefully that's going to be something that happens this year or next year, you know. But anyway, yeah, I think this is all from the top of my head. Also, maybe the sending to silent payment outputs is the more complicated part. So 375 needed the proofs to make sure that the other signers participated honestly. Otherwise, you could basically accidentally create or intentionally create outputs that burn funds instead of being spendable. The using of inputs is not as complicated because only the party that owns the silent payments input has to do special work there. When you send to it, all of the inputs are involved in the creation of the output. So there you need participation of all the input contributors.
Thank you, Merch. Yes, and that completes the newsletter.
Thanks, Gustavo and Merch. And we also want to thank Luis for joining us earlier, as well as Remix. And for you all for listening, thanks for your time. Cheers.
Cheers.